That's to say, look, when we look at someone is tested on a Rorschach blot, we assume that the story he tells about it is a projection. That is to say, it is only in his mind. And because it's only in his mind, the story he tells you about the Rorschach blot is symptomatic of his particular psychological condition. Are we then going to say that the external world has no order and no sense in it intrinsically, but that is something purely projected into it by human beings? And since human beings might differ from each other, as say one artist differs from another, or as one might have different kinds of brains, or different sense organs, does that mean that according to the differentiations in the individual, the external world is changed? Well, let's say this. When the astronomers use their telescopes and they discover that the stars are not angels, or they're not lights being carried in crystal spheres, but they discover these galaxies, when they discovered the galaxies, did they invent them? Were there galaxies there before anybody looked at them through telescopes? That's the same question as, when there is a noise, is it noisy if there's not anybody around to hear it? And of course, from a physical point of view, that old problem about the tree falling in the forest with no one to hear it is very simple. It's a problem of relativity. In other words, that the vibrations in air do not become noise until they hit an eardrum. Just as light going through space is not manifested as light until it falls upon a reflecting object. Just as a thing is not moving unless it can be shown to be moving in relation to something comparably still. So you see, in a way, there are no galaxies until there arises a situation responsive to them. Nothing exists by itself, but only in relation to other things. This is a rough point, but remember this, though. This isn't pure projection. Because the ability of the human being to have these sensory responses, to hear sounds, to see lights, and to know about galaxies and stars, the ability, the brain, which makes that possible, is in itself a member of the external world. The brain is a member of the same world it's looking at. It has something in common with the universe that surrounds it. You see, that was the thing that in the beginning we screened out. Nobody realizes that he's in the external world. Everybody else is, but I'm in the internal world. Oh, no, I'm not. I'm just as much in the external world as you, and my consciousness, my thoughts, my so on, can be regarded as something in the external world. So I go with it, you see. The external world, as I pointed out in the beginning, does me. Therefore, there are correspondences, there are transactions, there are relations between what I call me and everything else in the external world. Only I'm under the illusion that we don't go together. I've forgotten that I create the galaxies in the same moment that I've forgotten that the galaxies create me. It's mutual. Like two sides of a coin, they go together. You can't separate them. Otherwise, you have no coin. So then, in sum, let's go back. These are the principal meanings of Maya. Measurement through cutting. Play, magic,
drama and creative art. All fundamentally resting on the idea that the universe is not finally serious. And so the man who has penetrated Maya is a man who doesn't take life quite seriously. You see? Now there's something unnerving about that, isn't there? Because we use the word serious in two senses. When somebody says, "I love you," and the other person says, "Are you serious?" The answer is no, I'm sincere. Heavens, you don't want to be loved seriously, do you? I mean, what do you want, a Sturm und Drang, a kind of Tristan and Isolde relationship? Surely not. I mean, if you go in for that kind of thing, maybe that's your dish, but... do we really want the world to be serious, you see? Is God serious? Now, in Christianity, it seems that God is serious. Because nobody ever imagines that the one who sits on the throne of grace is sort of laughing. He may be very sad expression, very kind expression, very severe expression, but he wouldn't be laughing. No. Because we feel, you see, that anything that's in play and that isn't serious is in some way trivial. But that's not the case, you see. We have to get over that idea. And realize that the Lord, or whatever it is, that all this is about, it's doing all this, is having a ball, is playing. Even though the play sometimes involves scaring itself out of its wits. The universe creeps up behind itself and says, "Boo!" And it jumps, and all sorts of catastrophes happen, but ultimately they all change and disappear, and it all starts over again. See? It's this constant flowing in and out. And if things come, they must go. See? Going and coming are the same sides of one coin, you see. If they live, they must die. So it's all one. And after all, here we are, thinking we are living, but going around chewing up animals and vegetables and creating death in every direction, see. And we say this disappearance of those forms into this form, we think it's a good show. But imagine what a pretty girl's pearly teeth look like to an oyster.
Thanks for tuning into this program from Better Listen. Please visit betterlisten.com for more information about this program and the opportunity to share your comments and feedback with others. Better Listen presents Reality, Art, and Illusion, Part 2 with Alan Watts.
Well, now you know that one of the great problems that has arisen out of the Western study of Indian philosophy, as well as out of the tradition of Western philosophy, in relation to the whole problem of illusion, is the question of what is called in the technical jargon of Western philosophy, subjective idealism. This is the theory that all reality is mental. And we have to start by making a clear distinction between subjective idealism and solipsism. Solipsism is the doctrine that you are the only person who exists. and everybody else is your dream. And you can see there's a certain analogy between that and the Hindu idea that all this cosmos is the dream of the Godhead. But the difference here is that in the solipsistic doctrine, it is just you, as you more or less know yourself from a conscious standpoint, as a finite individual, and not much more than that, having this dream that all these other people exist. There's no way of really producing an argument against solipsism, because you can always say to a solipsist, what evidence, if someone could produce it, would you regard as disproving your idea? That's a very disconcerting question to ask anybody, and I give it to you if ever you get involved in philosophical one-upmanship. Ask a Freudian, what evidence, if it could be brought forward, would you consider to disprove the Oedipus complex theory? You'll find he can't think of anything at all. Or ask a theologian, what evidence would you find conclusive as disproving the existence of God? And he can't think of any. Whereas other people, if you ask them that question, will suggest an experiment and say, all right, if this experiment is negative, then we'll accept the evidence. And one of the classic experiments of this nature is the Michelson-Morley experiment, which disproved the existence of the ether, as at any rate in the form that people had conceived ether. And it's been generally accepted. Somebody thought out what would happen if there were really ether. So this is always one of the problems of solipsism, and we're going to see it's one of the problems of subjective idealism. But the difference between solipsism and subjective idealism is contained in the famous double limerick. There was a young man who said, God, I find it exceedingly odd that a tree as a tree simply ceases to be when there's no one around in the quad. And the reply, young man, your astonishment's odd. I'm always around in the quad, so the tree as a tree never ceases to be, since observed by yours faithfully, God. The great subjective idealists in the tradition of Western philosophy are, of course, Berkeley, the bishop, and Bradley. A.F. Bradley. And it's in some ways difficult to make out exactly what they were saying when they said that everything is in the mind, because they could never say clearly what they meant by the mind. But if you will be a little naive for a moment and seem at least to understand what you mean when you use the word mind, they will pitch the argument in the following way. You do not know anything except in your own mind. The whole existence of an external world is something known to you in your mind. The distance of other people and other objects from you is a distance that exists in the mind. You cannot possibly conceive any world existing unless it be an experience. How could there be an unexperienced world? That would not be a world for anyone or anything. Therefore it would not be at all, because being is always being for something. It is, in other words, relational. The sun is light for eyes. Eyes are organs of vision for a mind. If there are no eyes, the sun gives forth no light. If there are no nerve ends, it gives forth no heat. If there are no muscles, nothing is heavy, and if there are no soft skins, nothing is hard. Because it's only in relation to a certain softness that something hard can be said to be hard. Only in relation to a certain degree of measurement performed by the neurons that things can be said to be relatively hot or cold. Hot and cold are the impact of energies on a nervous system. Energies at all are recognized as energies by their impact on something. So the Zen poem says, the tree manifests the spiritual power of the wind, the water, the miraculous energy of the moon. So the tree is waving. And we wouldn't know there was any wind around, you see, unless there were a tree or something like it to wave in it. And in the same way as the moon, when the water ripples, breaks up into a thousand fragments and shimmers all over the place, you see, we wouldn't know that the moon had this miraculous power to duplicate itself, to triplicate, quadruplicate, multimillionaire itself, were it not for the water. So these are the foundations of the idealist theory. You must distinguish between philosophical idealism and ethical idealism. They're two totally unrelated ideas. Philosophical idealism means that only the ideal world is the real world, that is to say, the world in the mind. Now, the theory is incredibly plausible, as it has been stated by people like Berkeley and Bradley and the Western idealists. But today it is about the most unfashionable philosophical theory in the academic world that you could follow. Because Western philosophy has undergone a great revolution since about 1914. In that year, there was published Wittgenstein's Tractatus, and Wittgenstein came from the so-called Vienna School, or was influenced by the Vienna School, of people who call themselves scientific empiricists, sometimes logical analysts, sometimes logical positivists. And they said, only statements that are empirically verifiable have meaning. They never verified that statement, but that was their point of departure, that's their basic assumption. Everybody has a metaphysical assumption which he can't prove. Watch out for it. It's basic to all thought. For example, you must be consistent. Try and imagine a system of logic that isn't consistent. But at any rate, this school has had immense influence in the 20th century, and it argues, basically, that in order to say something meaningful, he's having fun. You must be able to verify it. That is to say, you verify things by prophecy. If you make a prediction based on your statement and it comes true, you verified it. If it doesn't come true, you haven't verified it. You've de-verified it. A statement which was de-verified, shown to be untrue, might be meaningful, but untrue. But a statement that you can't think any way of verifying it is, in this theory, meaningless. Now, so you say, the world is ruled by God. Everything that happens, happens under the governance of God. So the logical analyst says, you've made a statement now that says everything is affected by X, God. Suggest a way of verifying this. What difference would it make if it weren't so? Would it make any difference to the way things are going on if they weren't governed by God? This is a problem because it's just the same as if you had said, all bodies whatsoever in the universe, that includes all stars, all galaxies, all planets, are moving in a certain direction. Now, there's no way of verifying this because you can only verify movement in a certain direction by comparison with something that's relatively still. But there will not be any still body with reference to which